Quickly. Oh, there's one more. Oh, man. Okay, well, I'll be quick. So I'll try and convince you that we can still do some neat stuff in NMR. Particularly, there's hope of starting from pure states in NMR quantum computing, and that despite what Ike Shuang might say, NMR is not quite dead yet. So the need for purification. So it's pretty obvious that in the standard model of quantum computing, at least, sort of the DiVincenzo criteria, you need pure qubits in some fiducial state, both to start your computation, but it's not so obvious, but you still need them throughout the computation for fault tolerance purposes. So quantum error correction fault tolerance can be basically thought of as you start with your computer in some nice, cold, pure initial state, and as the computation goes on, it warms up when errors occur. And then every time you do error correction, you bring fresh, cold qubits in, you do your syndrome measurement and your error correction. That's ex basically extracting heat or entropy out of your system and purifying it again. So we're going to need some method for dynamically pumping entropy out of the system. And so just to get started, I'd like to, not even, okay, it's huge from down here. Just go over some quick basis stuff about bias, polarization, and temperature, because they're all basically equivalent, and we like to just jump between the different names. So of course, on the bottom, do I have a little pointer here? Not that I know how to use. Yellow. There we go. So we have our two-qubit density matrix, and if we start in some thermal state, and we imagine that the zero state is of lower energy, we'll have a slight population bias towards that state, and of course, there'll be a slightly less bit population in the excited state. And for most of the cases, all we care about is the relative population difference, which is going to be characterized by epsilon, the bias, and it's just going to vary between 0 and 1, because at infinite temperature, we just have equal populations in both. We're not going to consider negative temperature. And if you brought the temperature down to 0, you would perfectly polarize your system, or you had epsilon equal 1, or all the population in the ground state. You can think about it however you like. And of course, increasing bias equals decreasing temperature. So when we increase the bias of the spins, we call it cooling the spins, hence algorithmic cooling. And then on the right-hand side, I just threw up the probabilities if you have two, because they'll be useful in the next few bits. So of course, if you have 0, 0, you get 1 plus epsilon squared, 0, 1, and 1, 0 equal, and 1, 1 is 1 minus epsilon squared. So you can think about doing some simple purification without doing anything fancy. And so a pretty simple way to do it, of course, if you have projective measurements, you could even just measure, 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 and then once you return to 0, then you're pretty confident that you have a 0 there. If you have errors in your measurements, gates, and preparations, you have to do something a bit more fancy. And so an example is up here, C0, and then measure the bottom one. And so if you think about the possible inputs here, what will happen is if you have 0, 0, everything will go through. If you have 0, 1, or 1, 0, you'll end up with a 1 on the bottom, and you'll reject that state. And if you have 1, 1, you'll end up with a 1, 0, and so you'll take that with error. But if you remember the probabilities from the last slide, the 1, 1 state is the least probability. And so with this circuit, you can essentially push your error down to epsilon squared. If there's errors in the C0 or in the measurement, it's not quite so obvious, but you can still reduce your error this way, although not all the way to epsilon squared. So that's a simple purification. To do something more complex, we have to go back to von Neumann. And just as an aside, because I thought it was interesting, maybe it's obvious to the computer science people here, but if you have a biased coin, which is essentially a qubit at a non-zero temperature, how do you make that balanced? How do you perfectly initialize it? Well, again, going back to that second slide where we had the probabilities of the two-qubit states, the equal probabilities were 0, 1, and 1, 0. So what we'll do is we'll take this big binary bit string, which is biased here, and we'll take them in chunks of two, and we'll throw away all the 0, 0, and the 1, 1 pairs, and we'll only take the 0, 1, and the 1, 0 pairs. And then we can call 0, 1, 0, and 1, 0, 1, and we've made a perfectly unbiased coin, which I thought was kind of neat. Obviously, that's the opposite of what we really want to do, because we want to bias, we want to pump our system. But to turn it around, von Neumann was obviously trying to make a reliable quantum computer, or not quantum computer, just a reliable classical computer back in the 50s. And just as we learned with the quantum error correction yesterday, you basically just use redundant coding. So you do it three times and take a majority vote. And again, you can push your error down from epsilon to epsilon squared. And so Shulman and Verrazzani, a few years ago, about 10 years ago now, realized that you could use this ideas to pump up bias in qubits. And if you just keep applying this majority vote recursively, so apply the majority vote and then take the one vote out of that and take three copies of that, apply the majority vote again, and just use that over and over and over again, you can eventually completely polarize your qubits. And what was really neat about this is, as some of you may know, NMR is largely considered dead because it has what's called the scaling problem. And that is, as the number of qubits grow in your system, the size of your signal decreases exponentially. But that's only if you use the sort of standard, what are called pseudopure state preparation techniques. And it's just an artifact of that. And there's nothing inherently unscalable about NMR computing. There's practical issues that if you start with room temperature bias and you want to apply the Shulman-Varazani scheme, you'd need about 10 to the 12 qubits. But that does mean that if you wanted 100 qubits, you just need 100 times more that, or 10 to the 14. So it's ridiculous, but there's nothing inherently unscalable quantum computing. And if you started with more reasonable biases, which I'll explain how we can get at the end, if you started with biases of, say, 0.5 instead of 10 to the minus 5, like we currently have in room temperature, then a few rounds applying this majority vote could easily bring your qubits up to pure states. And you'd be over that hurdle, that requirement, that DiVincenzo requirement, and your NMR system would be scalable. OK, so what's limiting that Shulman-Varazani scheme? And of course, if your system's closed, we're limited by the entropy. And what you're essentially doing is you're heating up some parts of your system and cooling other parts. You're shifting the entropy around in your system. And that's all you can do. You can shift it around. And so that's basically limited by the Shannon entropy. If you only allow unitary dynamics, then you're further limited by what's called the Sorensen bound. And so as I've put up on the screen, the Shannon entropy basically, if considered linear, I think it's called the linear entropy, it's the trace of the eigenvalue squared. Whereas if you consider the Sorensen limit, all you can do is shuffle those eigenvalues around on your density matrix. And so relevant example for what comes later is that if you have three qubits and they all start with the same bias, you're only able to pump the bias of one of those qubits up to 1.5 times the initial bias. And that's as far as you can get if you have that closed system. There's nothing better you can do. No, so I'm just talking about the two limits. So if you just consider the Shannon entropy of the system, if you allow yourself some arbitrary, I don't know what kind of operation it would be, then all you have to preserve is the entropy of the system. But if you limit yourself to unitary dynamics, then you have to keep preserve the eigenvalues. Oops. So the solution to this is, of course, is to open the system up. Allow yourself to pump entropy out of the system. And what people commonly imagine is that certain types of qubits, let's call them the rapidly relaxing qubits, you can bring them in contact with a heat bath in a controlled manner, and they will re-thermalize. And you imagine if these qubits were the ones that you used in the majority gate, and that they were hot afterwards, these are the ones that you previously just ignored in the algorithm, if you just now bring them in contact with the heat bath, they'll cool back down to the heat bath temperature. You've pumped entropy out of your system, and you've bypassed the Shannon bound. So there's quite a few algorithms that came up around to take advantage of this. But thankfully, they all culminated in this beautiful optimal partner pairing algorithm, again from Shulman and Wiseman and a few others. And the nice thing about this optimal algorithm, not only does it give us an explicit method of how to go about algorithmic cooling with the heat bath, but also gives a threshold effect so that you can show that if your polarization starts much below 1 over 2 to the n, where n is the number of qubits you have, then you don't have any hope of purifying your qubit, even if you have this heat bath. And the best you can do is you can sort of boost it by 2 to the n minus 2. And so in our case, for 3 qubits, which I'll explain the results in a second, this means we can only boost polarization by a factor of 2. But of course, if you imagine a few more qubits, it very quickly grows. But the really nice thing is once you get above that threshold, then you know that if you just keep repeatedly applying this algorithm, you're going to be able to purify your qubits arbitrarily. And that threshold for a few qubits is not that high. It's well within reach with standard techniques. OK, so what do we actually apply this in? Why do we care about this? Nuclear magnetic resonance. I'm sure most of you either know about it or maybe saw Glaser's introduction, so I won't spend too much time on it. Of course, our qubits are nuclear spins in a strong magnetic field. But even though that magnetic field is strong, the nuclear spins are so weak that the energy difference between the two spins is so small, and at room temperature, we only have biases of about 10 to the minus 5. And so we control the qubits through radio frequency fields. So we apply these pulses and rotations, as again, I'm sure you've seen in Glaser's thing. And of course, we don't have projected measurements. So we have to use something like algorithmic cooling. We can only measure expectation values. So what's our system? So the system is malonic acid. I'll go through this a bit more, because it's different from the liquid state that maybe some of you have seen. We use 3 qubits in the system. So these black guys are carbons. And if you label those carbons with carbon 13, isotopically label them with carbon 13, they're spin 1/2. And those are our qubits. That's our system. The big blue guys are oxygens. And for the large part, they're spin 0. So they don't interact, at least magnetically, with the rest of our system. And so we can ignore them. The white guys are more important. They're protons. And protons are spin 1/2. So you can imagine using them as qubits. I think Martin volunteered to tell you how this afternoon. But we're not going to use them as qubits here. We're going to use them as our heat bath. And so what we're actually going to have is we're not just going to have a single molecule. Is in solid state, we have a crystal. And so we're going to have a single crystal. So all these molecules are lined up periodically in exactly the same orientation. And then every once in a while, we're going to take, triply label one of these guys with the 3 carbons, and there's our processor. So if we only do that every once in a while, let's say 1 or 2 or 3% of the molecule, then those processor molecules are far enough apart. All the rest of the carbons in the molecule, which we haven't labeled, are carbon 12, which is spin 0, again, invisible to us. But these protons are 100% abundant. So these protons are everywhere throughout the crystal, and they're all talking to each other, which is very different to liquid state, where the molecules are tumbling and don't talk to each other. And this proton bath, our proton spin network, forms the heat bath from which we can extract polarization. And I'll explain how to do that. So we want to do a selective refresh. We want to be able to reset one of the qubits. We want to be able to bring one of the qubits in contact with the heat bath. And the way to do this is, well, there's a few ways, but the way we did it was something called cross-polarization. So what we want, let's go back to the molecule. It's even obvious from the geometry in this molecule that this carbon here, it's called the methylene carbon, because these two protons are a methylene group, are going to be much stronger, has a much stronger coupling to the protons than the other two carbons. And so if we bring the carbons in contact with the protons, basically only the methylene will talk to them at first. And then, of course, over time, the much weaker couplings with the other two carbons will bring those into contact as well with the proton network. But at the short time, only the methylene talks to the protons. And how does it talk to them? This is basically a technical detail, but what we want to do is swap polarization from the protons to the carbons. Because they're different nuclei, we only have a Z-Z interaction, which isn't good enough for a swap unless we have good coherent control. And we can transform a Z-Z into a swap. But we don't even need good coherent control. We basically just have to blast both of the spins at the same mutation frequency, it's called, just rotate them at the same rate. And if we do that, you can work it out that the average Hamiltonian of the ZZ goes to ZZ plus YY. And of course, the swap that we really want is ZZ plus XX plus YY, the full Heisenberg exchange coupling. But if we only put in an input state, let's say the input state X, then this looks like this is just as good as the full swap. And it will perform the swap from the protons to the carbons. And again, if we only do it for a short time, then we only swap to that one carbon. So there's our refresh step. So we've got that solved. So what does the whole mess look like? So this is the whole circuit that we do. As usual, PowerPoint makes it all blurry. So the first step is this refresh. So we have the rest of the proton bath here. We have HM1, M2, those two protons strongly coupled to the methyl carbon, and then CM, that carbon, and then C1 and C2, the other two carbon. So we perform the refresh step first, and we've brought CM down to the heat bath temperature, and then we perform some carbon operation. It looks like a mess. It's kind of interesting. It's always amazing to me. These are our control fields here for one particular pulse that swaps polarization from CM to C1. It's a unitary swap gate. And it looks like an absolute mess, but this is what optimal control theory gives us. And so we perform the swap, and then we run the refresh again. And you may ask why you can run the refresh again, and that's because while we're running this swap gate on the carbons, the methylene protons are talking to the rest of the protons in the crystal. They're not isolated from the rest of the molecules. And so the dipolar network will actually refresh those two protons and bring them back to the heat bath temperature. So when we run the second refresh step here, we again refresh the methylene carbon back to the heat bath polarization. We can swap that onto C1, run the refresh again, and then we've built up the heat bath polarization on all three of the carbons. And then we can run the majority gate, or the compression gate, or whatever you want to call it. It's sort of shown decomposed here as Toffoli's and C0-naughts. And but once we do that, we've built up 1.5 polarization on C2, and then 0.5 and 0.5 on the other two. So that would be as far as you can go with conventional cooling, or limited by the Shannon bound. But of course, we can run it again. We can, because now CM and C2 are only at 0.5 times the heat bath polarization, if we bring them in contact with the proton, they'll be cooled, and we'll have pumped entropy out of the system. And there goes my computer into sleep mode. There we go. So we can keep repeating that, and that's what we were able to do for four steps. And like I said, the limiting polarization of this whole technique is 2 times the heat bath polarization. After 4 steps, you'd be at 1.94. Of course, life isn't perfect, and we weren't able to do that. We were still able to go by that 1.5 boundary that you could imagine. So on the one we were pumping, we went sort of 1.39, 1.56, 1.64, and then topped out at 1.69. And you can also see that it leads to a substantial increase in your polarization. So this is C2, these two peaks here. So initially, the blue curve, which may be hard to see, sort of goes 2/3 of the way up there. And then after you run the heat bath algorithm of cooling, you've got polarization on the other two, and you've boosted the polarization on there. It may not seem that significant, but it's actually significant even in the absence of quantum computing motivation. And signal to noise is always a huge issue in NMR. That's why people buy those huge magnets, because every time you double the size of your magnet, you double your signal. But this may provide a way around that, because if you can boost your signal without having to buy a bigger magnet, you could save yourself experiment time. And the reason of that is because to enhance signal to noise, as some of you may know, you can signal average. And of course, your signal to noise grows as the square root of the number of experiments you do. So if you double your signal to begin with, you only have to do 1/4 the number of experiments, which could lead to huge experiment savings times. Because lots of NMR experiments actually take days to run just to get the signal to noise, especially on larger molecules. And the plot on the very bottom is sort of the information content, or sort of the total polarization of the molecule, showing how that grows as the course of the experiment grows. So that's it. So we're able to do it. It does work. And the next steps would be much more neat. So this is just showing it on very low biases. You know, if you go from 10 to the minus 5 to 2 to the 10 to the minus 5, it's not that impressive. But if you think about any electron nuclear system, electrons have about, let's say, 1,000 times stronger magnetic moment than the protons. And so at any temperature, they're 1,000 times more polarized. And so if you go down to liquid helium temperatures, and then you pump on the liquid helium to bring it down to about a Kelvin, and you use just sort of typical magnetic field strengths, those electrons are almost fully polarized. And if you then use the electron as your reset bit, the electron has a very fast T1, so you can imagine that as being coming in contact with the heat bath, and you swap the polarization off the electron and then compress that electron polarization, you could actually purify your nuclear spins. And so that's the next goal of our work. And that's it. Devin. Sorry? Okay, so that's sort of the three. That's sort of if you did conventional what's called cross-polarization, so if any solid-state NMR person would say to me, okay, you boosted the polarization of your carbon, well, I can do that just by doing this cross-polarization technique where I don't have to worry about all this fancy quantum control. I just blast my carbons and my protons, and they'll talk to each other, and they'll eventually come into equilibrium. But that three is as far as you could go with that. But if you actually do this, you know, controlled interaction, swaps, compression gates, then you can go beyond that. I thought there was another talk, he said. So I'm not quite following the question. Well, you can get specially designed cryostats for superconducting magnets. We have a couple in the lab. And so they basically just drop into the center of the superconducting bore. And yeah. Yeah, so it certainly does. You want the nuclei, or wherever you're storing your polarization, to have a very long relaxation time. So you can store it while you're doing these refresh operations and compression gates. And of course, if you hope to really purify a qubit, you're going to have to fuss about these errors, and they will limit the sort of polarization you can actually achieve. But if we can get up to 99%, we'll be very happy. Devin again. So they do and they don't. I mean, so the main issue is that a lot of NMR is done in liquid state, and of course there you're limited by room temperature. In solid state NMR, people do. The issue there is that usually your relaxation times sort of go inversely proportional with temperature. And so your waiting time between experiments, while you wait for your spins to come back into thermal equilibrium, usually grows faster than any gain you get from the signal boost from the temperature. So we weren't decreasing, we're actually just flatlining, like, so flatlined, yeah. So the errors here are basically that our heat bath is finite size. Like, our heat bath is basically the four proton spins for that one carbon spin, and then multiplied by our dilution. And so every time we use it, we actually heat up the heat bath a bit. Mm-hmm.